presents to us the third part in his study of Samuel. And tonight's talk is entitled, Mother and Child, a Character Study of Hannah and Samuel. Brother Colin.
Good evening, brothers and sisters, and young people and friends. Of the Lord's mother, it was said, Blessed art thou among women. No greater privilege, no greater woman. If this was the finest compliment ever paid to a woman of faith, it is also indirectly a lovely tribute to Samuel's mother, that her prayer became the main source for Mary's prayer, the mother of our Lord, the most godly among women. Could there be a finer introduction to Samuel's mother, a better insight into what was the most critical influence in Samuel's formative years? We've mentioned earlier the parallels between Samuel's early years and that of our Lord. We looked at Luke chapter 2 and verse 52, where the Lord's growth from the time he was at the period of the temple, when he answered the doctors of the law, is described in terms that hearken back to the growth and the development of young Samuel. We notice in Luke's record how Mary exalts the Lord on high in language that draws heavily upon Hannah's prayer. There are two touchstones that we can see thus far. The contents of Mary's prayer, drawn largely from the prayer of Hannah, and the growth of our Lord in wisdom and stature, described in terms drawn from the description of the child Samuel. But really, there's more. For we find in our Lord's life that although Joseph and Mary come to our attention immediately in the record of Christ's birth, Mary figures far more prominently than does Joseph. Joseph finally fades from the scene, and that at a very early stage. You see the similarity to Samuel? Both Hannah and Elkanah come to our attention in 1 Samuel verses 1, 2, and 3. Elkanah is mentioned only incidentally thereafter, and that only about twice. Elkanah, the father, fades from the picture. But attention is given to the mother, to Hannah. There, then, is a most intriguing third parallel to the early childhood and the parentage of Samuel, on the one hand, and our master, on the other. What a great tribute it is to Samuel as a parallel to the Lord, to Hannah as a parallel to Mary. And furthermore, what a tribute to this little family of Hannah, her other fellow wife, her husband, and the family that revolved around that godly circle, as but a cameo in a small way of a much greater family that would be coming many years after, as a fulfillment in part of Hannah's prayer. Do you know, throughout the life of Samuel, there are many stark contrasts. We've met some of them already in our first two talks. In the life of Samuel, we meet two parents. We meet, on the one hand, Hannah, the godly parent, and on the other hand, we meet Eli, the self-indulgent, spiritually blind, and undiscerning parent. We meet Hannah, a most perceptive parent. We meet Eli, who indeed had overlooked much. We also find two types of youth. We find in Eli's sons of Belial, to use the scriptural expression. But in the case of Samuel, we find a godly young boy. Remember how we saw that contrast brought out earlier on, but it comes from our reading. Let's look at 1 Samuel 2. Verse 17 and 18, we looked at this earlier on, didn't we? The contrast in the life of Samuel, one against the other. On the one hand, in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 2, we read, "Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord. But Samuel ministered before the Lord being a child, girded with a linen ephod." Men of Belial. Young men of Belial. A young child in the case of Samuel, whose ears and whose mind and heart are open and attuned to God's ways. The very opposite of these young rebels in the truth. Eli's sons are stunted in their spiritual growth, and they're cut off in the prime of their youth. But of Samuel, it says, as we've noticed earlier, chapter 2, verse 21, at the end of that verse, rather than being cut off, Samuel goes on and grows and develops. The child Samuel grew before the Lord. And verse 26, the child Samuel grew on and was in favor. He developed into maturity and finally into an old man, howbeit an elder in Israel. But these young striplings that were rebels in the truth were cut off in the prime of their youth. One contrasted against the other. In each of the pairs, the parents, the fathers, the sons, in each of those pairs, one character serves to highlight the virtues or the weaknesses of the other. We appreciate Samuel even more as a young man when we consider him against the godless sons of Eli. And their ungodliness in turn is shown up more intensely when we view them in contrast to Samuel. Hannah is first brought to our attention as a faithful worshiper, a very important introduction to a person in Scripture. We find her first introduced to us in chapter 1 in worship. That's when our attention is drawn to first. Chapter 1, with her family, we find her in bitterness of soul, verse 10 of chapter 1. She prays unto the Lord, and she weeps sore. When she's cross-examined by Eli, in verse 14, and asked, "How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee." Notice, perhaps, what is a play on words in verse 15 by Hannah. Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink." Then she says, "But have poured out my soul before the Lord." You see the play? I have not poured out wine to myself. I have not indulged in debauchery and drunkenness. What I have done, using the same figure, I have poured out my soul, as it were, like a libation. For there was, of the offerings under the law, a drink offering. And the pouring out of that wine and that drink offering was a commitment. It was a symbol of dedication. It was a pouring out to the Lord. She had not poured out wine to herself, but she had poured out her soul in emptying herself before God's throne. She is a spiritually minded woman. A young spiritually minded woman is Hannah, who could so quickly and yet so modestly and yet so effectively, by that figure of speech, pick up his accusation and turn it around to a description of what she was truly doing in pouring out her soul, as it were, like a drink offering. Hers was a commitment and a dedication to God, not something that was a sign of self-indulgence and self-centeredness. There is a godly woman who can answer and think in those terms. And although her sincerity is challenged by Eli, she is able, in a modest and yet effective way, to defend herself. We thereby find what she really is like. If it wasn't for Eli's accusation being disclosed to us and the dialogue between Hannah and Eli, we wouldn't know exactly what her true attitude was, except for her prayer in chapter 2, which we'll look at momentarily. We are introduced then to a woman who bears a cross, as it were, for she does not have a child. It is in the bitterness of her soul that she poured herself out like a drink offering, offering herself to the Lord and her son if God so answered the prayer. She has, then, not a perfect domestic life. Do you know, brothers and sisters and young people, we sometimes ask why it is that our domestic life is sometimes disturbed in its peace and harmony. We have a loss of a loved one. We are inflicted with some kind of malady or illness. Or perhaps a member of our family is afflicted with something that is less than perfect health. And we find life perhaps difficult to bear. Life perhaps becomes, for a period of time, a grind. Domestic life is spoiled. Peace and harmony is soured. And we wonder why. And we wonder how we're going to bear up under it. There are different ways that domestic harmony can be disrupted. Or as a young person, we find for a period of time we haven't friends in the CYC. Or we feel lonely when we're in the meeting. Or we find that perhaps it's difficult to become part of the group or part of the crowd. Or perhaps we find at home we are a member of the family that, in our own perception, in our own way of looking at it, as a young person, we don't think we're loved as much as mom and dad love the others. Something spoils or warps our domestic, everyday home life. For this woman, her domestic life was spoiled. Life was good, but it wasn't so good. She had a lot to be thankful for, but she was in bitterness of soul. There's a woman we can identify with, whether we're man or woman, young or old. For there was nothing greater in a woman's life, as today, so then, than to bear a child, let alone a son, to carry on one's husband's name. If it's important now, it was even more so then. She was a woman who was bearing a cross, and it revolved around a domestic life that was far from perfect. She had tensions in her home, as some of us do. Tensions not between husband and wife, but it might as well have been, for she had tensions between herself and her husband's second wife. And she was envious, in a certain sense, no doubt. And she grieved that she had not a son, whereas the other did. Those tensions perhaps we can't identify with if we're not quite in that kind of situation. But whether we have been in that situation exactly or not, here's a domestic scene which is spoiled. Here are tensions in a home. It's not a completely perfect home. And yet, it's a challenge to discipleship. Hannah will come out of this situation the better. Her fellow sister wife may not, but Hannah will. Through her affliction and her bitterness, she is forced even more so upon the Lord. She pours out her soul before the Lord. Her crisis brings her before her Lord. And she relieves her tension, and she presents that petition before the Lord. It's only him that can listen, and only he who can heal the wound and relieve the bitterness and subdue the tension. You see how we can step into her shoes momentarily. We too, all of us, have had or will have that kind of domestic crisis from time to time. It may not be a marital problem. It could be something with our children or with ourselves. Something that spoils the scene, as it were. And it may go on, and it may go on and on and on for a long time, as perhaps it must have seemed to this young woman who wanted to be a mother. But she bore that cross. How did she bear that cross? You noticed how she does it? She bears the cross by sharing it. Isn't that the key? She bears her cross by sharing its weight with someone else. In this case, and most importantly, she shares the weight of it with her Lord. She prostrates herself before God. She allows him to lift up the weight of that cross that she's bearing so that the weight of it and the misery of it is shared. That's critical, isn't it? For no matter what the crisis is, no matter what the tensions, no matter what it is that spoils complete perfect harmony and peace, the weight of the cross is always lighter when we allow it to be shared, when we allow the Lord to share the burden. Do you know, that's so simple, isn't it, to say that, but it's so profoundly important when we're in a crisis. We find a certain amount of relief by sharing it with others, fellow brothers and sisters, and no doubt that's intended. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. Paul exhorted along those lines. But most importantly, the weight of it is most effectively borne when it's shared by God. When we go to God in prayer regularly in a crisis, when we share it with Him, then the weight of it is much less. And it's intended to be so. The privilege of prayer, when capitalized on, when used that way, becomes effective and meaningful. And so she found, being a woman of prayer, that the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man or woman availed much. For she took heart from the words of the priest and took heart that her prayer had been answered. There is such a consistency when you look at the character of Hannah. A woman found, first of all, in worship, a woman in prayer, a woman who could answer ever so firmly and yet also graciously the accusation of Eli. She could deflect it, the accusation, so effectively, with such a scriptural perspective that she was pouring out her own soul, is what she was doing. But notice in verse 16 another phrase that's very telling. If we just take a look closely at how she presents herself, she describes herself when she prostrates herself before God in a most humble fashion. Down to verse 18. And she said, "Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight." So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. The key point to notice is how she describes herself. She describes herself as a handmaid. Says a certain amount about her self-perspective, doesn't it? She viewed herself as one in proper perspective, merely a handmaid. It's the language of being a servant. It's the perspective of Samuel. Remember how earlier on we noticed that phrase time and again in respect to Samuel, that he ministered unto the Lord, he ministered unto the Lord, he ministered unto the Lord. Some 5 or 6 times that is said in 3 chapters. We noticed also when Samuel was in the temple, he said, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." That's the disposition of a godly disciple, man or woman, seeing ourselves in the capacity of serving. "I am a handmaid," she said. And Samuel said, "I am a servant." And he saw his role as ministering. And what does a handmaid do? She ministers. She ministers at hand. She views herself as, in a certain sense, a maid to others. There's the very opposite of the perspective of Eli and the perspective of Eli's sons. Notice, if we just see the contrast. In 1 Samuel, chapter 2, verse 29, when the perverted form of sacrifice is described, we see a perspective that is the very opposite. The very opposite of what we see with Hannah and her prayer. For look at the self-centeredness indicated in verse 29 of 1 Samuel 2. "To Eli and his family, wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at mine offering, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, and make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people." Make yourselves fat. They were inflicted with a disease called meism. Self-centered they were, concerned more about making themselves fat. Meism, it's a disease of the 20th century as much as it was then. Me, what I want, my pleasures, my desire, my house, my car, my clothes, my looks, my appearance, my wages, my profession, my time, my energy. Me, myself, the center of the universe. But not so with a man like Samuel, who ministered to others. Not so with a man like Samuel, who said, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." Not so with a woman who views herself as the handmaid of the Lord. Notice how that's reinforced in John's gospel. It was a lesson, simple but forcefully brought forward by Jesus, in some of his last words in the upper room, John 13. It's the spirit of Christ, the spirit of seeing oneself as a servant in the ecclesia and towards one's fellows. John 13. Verse 14. In the upper room, Jesus says, to those in that small circle who desperately needed this lesson as much as you and I, John 13, verse 14, if I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet. Of course, that's the role of a handmaid, isn't it? That's the role of a household servant. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. You see the point Jesus is driving home to them? They must take on themselves the position of being handmaids, as it were, or servants one to another in the household. It's easy to use the word, but it's another thing to show its character. Do we see that character in the person of Hannah? We do. For when her prayer was answered and a son was given, she kept her vows. And how did she view her child that she had been blessed with? To her, as a parent, a child was to be viewed as one who was on loan. She prayed that if she had a son, she would give him back to the Lord. As a parent, she viewed her children not from the philosophy of meism, my child, my little boy, but rather a child of the Lord, potentially speaking. She viewed her children as children to be given back to the Lord. They were only on loan to her. And in Samuel, before he can dedicate himself to the Lord, she dedicates him. But although she dedicates him first, he accepts her dedication and cooperation. Free will in Samuel was not overridden, but the commitment to service came from parent first. Hannah created a home environment and a training and an example. She did her role as parent. But when the child was old enough to make his own decision, he made it the right way. You see, there wasn't in Hannah the philosophy sometimes in our ecclesias, the philosophy of free choice for young children. There was no free choice, not for Samuel as a young boy. She promised before he said anything that he was going to be a child in the ecclesia. She viewed him as a potential for ecclesial work. She promised that he would serve in the ecclesia. She saw to it that he had the right training. She understood that proverb that says, train up a child in the way that he shall go, and he will not depart from it afterwards. Although some obviously do. That was her perspective. She committed him. And by doing so, she committed herself as a mother in Israel. It wasn't a matter of, well, children have to make their own choice, you know. Do you want to go to a meeting or not? No. Fine, we'll leave you at home. No. That wasn't her philosophy. It wasn't the philosophy that says, well, you know what the children are like. They have to make a choice for themselves. You can't be pushing them along all the time. Well, there's a time, of course, when that is true, when perhaps they're taller than us. But that wasn't the philosophy of Hannah. She committed him to the service of the Lord and created an environment that lent itself to that commitment. And before he had any choice in the matter, she took him by the hand. And she brought him to the temple. And she dedicated him to that temple, and she kept her vow. That was not the philosophy of free choice. Not as long as the child was still a child. She trained up that child in the way that he should go. You see, she understood, didn't she, the language back in Genesis. Let's go back there. It's the language given to the patriarchs so early on in Israel's history concerning childbearing and child rearing. Genesis chapter 18. It's in the life of Abraham. Very telling statement. Says God about Abraham, and it's very telling what it tells us about Abraham's godly perspective. It's that of Hannah. Genesis 18, verse 17. And the Lord said, Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him, for I know him, that he will not ask, not beg. He will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. There was something unique about Abraham as a father, or perhaps not so much unique as vitally important. In choosing Abraham as the father of the faithful, the progenitor of the nation of Israel, there was a quality in that man that God centers in on right here. He was a man who, as a father, would see his role as commanding his children to follow the ways of God. He wouldn't just ask. It wouldn't be something that would be bartered for, negotiated over the breakfast table on Sunday morning as to whether you go to Sunday school or not. The children went. It wasn't a matter of unkindness, hard-heartedness. It would have been done, no doubt, in the spirit of mercy, kindness, gentleness. Wouldn't have been contrary to the exhortation, provoke not your children to wrath. But they would have gone. And there would have been no choice as long as the child was still in those formative years, especially. Before the years of true independence, the children would be brought. And that's a point, isn't it? Hannah and her husband take their children to the place of worship. That says something, doesn't it? They went up as a family on that feast day to celebrate the feast, hand in hand, as it were. Despite the domestic tensions and the spoiled situation at home, they nevertheless went up as a small little group to worship that day. You see, the child wasn't sent to Sunday school, mothers and fathers. He was brought to Sunday school. That says something about us, doesn't it? Do you know, when I was brought up in the United Church, I remember standing in front of that church many a times and watching parents come by in cars and dropping off their children. Do you know, that's becoming a practice in Christadelphian circles more than it ever was before, where children are dropped off to Sunday school and parents go over to the coffee store around the corner, or they go home and then come back again. This child was brought by parents together, and they stayed together as long as that worship was taking place. There's a very practical point in terms of having the children turn out the way we want them to turn out. Training up the child is not just pointing fingers and doing the readings and smacking hands, although that's needed at times, perhaps. It's a matter of going together. It's a matter of taking the child with us, supporting the ecclesia together, collectively. All go together to worship. So if we wonder what kind of secret, so-called, might have been in Hannah's life, that perhaps discloses at least one. Apart from her own personal example, they worship together as a family, something we ought not to lose sight of. Brothers and sisters, there's something else, though, when we come back to Samuel. In chapter 2, we find a prayer. How much can you learn about a person from his or her prayer? I'm speaking now not so much of a public prayer where one feels particularly tense and perhaps one isn't one's own in public prayer, especially if one is a young person or one feels particularly insecure in public prayer. For this wasn't a public prayer. But what does God find he can learn in the prayer or the worship of one of his disciples? Must be a great deal is disclosed in the Spirit's mind by watching us pray when we do at night, and say grace when we do in the day, and pray as we might in certain public places as well. To the Father's mind and discernment, a lot must be able to be read, which of course we cannot. But we can read between the lines in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Jesus stated it clearly when he said, "Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh." And what is it that this woman is full of? What does she say? Out of the abundance of her heart, she speaks. And what does she speak? Let's look at her prayer closely. and say grace when we do in the day, and pray as we might in certain public places as well. To the Father's mind and discernment, a lot must be able to be read, which of course we cannot. But we can read between the lines in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Jesus stated it clearly when he said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And what is it that this woman is full of? What does she say? Out of the abundance of her heart, she speaks. And what does she speak? Let's look at her prayer closely. Hannah prayed and said, my heart rejoiceth in the Lord. Mine horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. It starts, doesn't it, on a very positive note. My heart rejoices in the Lord. The truth, nevertheless, had not been soured. We reflect on the domestic tensions we just talked about. Her life wasn't perfect, was it? There was something short of bliss in her house. Something short of bliss, for sure. She was suffering from certain strains and dislocations in her family. Between her and this other wife, there must have been some tensions. It would seem that that was so. But despite the spoiled domestic scene and the imperfectness of her home, in that sense, she could sincerely say, my heart rejoices in the Lord. She was able, this godly woman, to rise above it all. She may not have done it immediately. She may have taken some time to rise above it, but she did finally. For in this, we see sincerely true godly joy, although she's bearing a cross. She says, my horn is exalted in the Lord. She recognizes the Lord is able to lift her up. My mouth is enlarged over my enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. How was her mouth enlarged over her enemies? Well, in the sense of what she's praying about. For it's a song as much as it is a prayer. What comes out of her mouth is prophetic and true. No doubt it is guided by the Spirit in a certain sense, although she wasn't aware of it. For what comes out of her mouth shows her confidence that in the future, she and her family in Israel will be finally enlarged over their enemies. Now, that touches a keynote in Hannah's prayer. For not far down the street, as it were, the Philistines were on the doorstep of Hannah and Elkanah and Samuel. This is Dagon, the fish god of the Philistines. Dagon, of course, was enshrined in one of the key Philistine cities, not too far from any Israelite. And as we saw in one of our earlier studies, in the days of Samuel, Dagon and his followers had begun to encroach on almost every corner of Israel's borders. As we read the book of Samuel, we find they'd even incurred as far as Bethlehem, some of the upper towns in the hills of Judah. The Philistines were a daily threat. We must bear that in mind in terms of her daily circumstances, the issues of the day, if we're going to understand her prayer. So, despite her own domestic problems, there was something that every Israelite was afraid of, and that was the world. For this pagan idol epitomized a threat to Israel's existence. The Philistines had been a problem all through the Judges. Samson had only kept them at bay temporarily, and his work wasn't finished. For we're told that Samson only began to destroy the Philistines. But it's in the life of Samuel we see the job virtually complete, though not complete all the way. The world was a constant threat. If there was immorality in Israel, there was immorality in the Philistines' way of worship and in their influence at the doorsteps of Israel. That was a very real problem to Hannah. She was conscious of the world she was living in. You watch how we will go through her prayer and see how the details of her prayer show a consciousness of the world scene as well as the ecclesial scene. She wasn't an uninformed sister just because she was a sister. She was a sister very tuned in to the world threat around Israel's borders. That was a symbol of godlessness. Dagon stood for pagan idolatry of the worst sort. He was a symbol of fertility, with all the various immoral forms of cult worship that was entailed in the worship of Dagon. A hideous god. A god that was brought with the Philistines wherever they went. So when we come back to Samuel's mother's prayer, she is concerned not only about herself. She's not only concerned about having a son, which she dearly wants. She is concerned very much about a wider picture, ecclesially. She's concerned about the enemies of God and about the freedom of her people. Let's go down to verse 2. Well, let's just follow the contents of her prayer, step by step. Reveals so much about this mother of this son. There is none holy, she continues, as the Lord, for there is none beside thee. Neither is there any rock like our God. Confidence, faithfulness, trust. Viewing God as a rock, the language of the law, back in Deuteronomy, where Moses prayed, the Lord is our rock. Furthermore, talk no more, she says, so exceeding proudly. Let not arrogancy come out of your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge. By him, actions are weighed. Think of the context. Eli, his sons, those sons of Belial. By Yahweh, she says, actions are weighed. And here she is, under the observation of Eli, whose actions were about to be weighed. And in the language of Daniel, they'd be found wanting. Hophni, Phinehas, dead men within a very short time. A nation losing its ark, the glory to be departed. Ecclesially, she understands a very basic first principle, that by God actions are weighed, both for the Gentile and for the ecclesia. The bows of the mighty men, she says, are broken. And they that stumble are girded with strength. Now think of the two. First, once again, as we've underlined it in red, she mentions the enemies of the ecclesia. And then she says, they that stumble are girded with strength. Those that appear weak, those that appear to stumble, like perhaps those who are of lesser stature than the Philistines in terms of human strength, will finally be exalted. Let's go further. Verse 5, they that were full have hired out themselves for bread. They that were hungry ceased. So that the barren hath borne 7, and she that hath many children is waxed feeble. See the contrast all through her prayer. On the one hand, there's the enemies of God. On the other hand, there's the friends of God. On the one hand, there are the privileged that have been temporarily elevated. There's the so-called strong and mighty of this world. On the other hand, there's those that are like her, the handmaids of the Lord, those that are despised and in lesser positions of authority. It's a prophecy, isn't it? It's a prophecy that looks down the halls of time and sees a time when those who are the underdog, the underprivileged, will be exalted. A little further. Verse 6. The Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and he bringeth up. The Lord maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and lifteth up. He raiseth up the poor out of the dust and lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill. Now notice this language. We're going to underline phrases like this in blue. To set them among princes, and to make them inherit the throne of glory. But wait a minute. When Hannah prays this prayer, or expresses this song, is there a king in Israel? Is there a throne? Is Israel in the period of a monarchy? They are not. There is no throne in Israel. Is there? There is no king. Is there? Or is there? For when the people clamored to have Saul a king, like all the other nations, it was at that time, if they hadn't seen it before, that Samuel tells the nation that God is their king. And he has been dethroned, in a certain sense, in their minds, by demanding a visible king like the nations. So although there's no visible monarchy, do you see what Hannah knows? What she believes? What she can see? She knew what Saul didn't, and most of the people. She knew that there was a king in Israel, and there was a throne, and that there would be one, in a very real sense, in the future. You see, Hannah understood her first principles, as it were. She had a very good grasp of her Bible. Now, we stress that because what's the lesson to us, brothers and sisters? And it's a lesson not only to sisters, it's a lesson to brothers. Can you identify with her prayer? If you were to go home tonight in prayer and pray before the Lord, would you be able to pack into your prayer, unnoticed and unintentionally, as a sincere prayer, that kind of content? That kind of reference to scriptural principles, that kind of allusion to scriptural thought and incident, could you? I think all of us would fail. Here is a handmaid of the Lord. Where did she get this Bible knowledge from? How could she possibly speak in such scriptural terms? Every thought is packed with meaning. Not a word is wasted. Had she prayed before publicly? Had she stood before thousands? Had she spoke at gatherings? Had she presided over various meetings to get experience in praying? She had not. She was a sister who, taking her rightful role in Israel, had not had that kind of experience. But look at the contents of her prayer, sisters and brethren. How does a sister acquire that kind of Bible knowledge? Is it by spending all day long in the kitchen? By always tending to diapers? By always spending her time only with food, clothing, and domestic concerns, important as they are for sisters? Obviously, it's not acquired by filling a day up entirely with those domestic concerns. Important as they too are part of serving the Lord. Let's not despise them. Was it by packing in two or three extra jobs? To put in extra plush carpeting to buy another house? Is that kind of Bible knowledge usually acquired by someone who is constantly a working mother apart from domestic concerns? How come she knows this and understands it? It was absorbed, no doubt, through a slow process, but a steady process, so that as a young sister, out of the abundance of her heart, her mouth spake. She was no doubt a woman who had her priorities, and they weren't with buying a better rug, with having four dresses when perhaps she only could have two. She was like the principle illustrated between Mary and Martha, one who was more absorbed than she should have been in domestic concerns, as opposed to the other, who Jesus said had chosen the better part and was sitting at the Master's feet. Two women, it's not an indictment against domestic concerns, but it's a matter of emphasis and priority which those two women needed. Or at least one of them needed. She has chosen the better part. There was a woman that gravitated to the feet of the Master, who knew that as a sister, her preoccupation with spiritual things was vitally important. And what of the brethren? Do we encourage our sisters to learn as much as we desire to learn? Do we create a home environment that's conducive to sisters learning the truth and enriching themselves? Do we encourage, as brethren, our sisters, young and old, before they're baptized and after, to be hungry and thirsty for the word? Or do we fill our domestic circle with cottages, or who knows what, that might distract us more than is needed? What is our priority? Some of those things don't need to be a distraction. Sometimes they can be. Do we fill, brethren, our lives with all kinds of hobbies that drags our sister wife in, so that less and less time is able to be given to Bible study? Brethren have a profound influence on creating a home situation that's conducive, lends itself to sisters becoming enriched in the Word. Do we study with our sisters, with our sister wives? Do we create ecclesial situations that encourage sisters to become enriched, to grow in the truth? It's possible to stifle our sisters. It's possible to discourage Bible study for sisters. It's see a prayer like that. We wouldn't see a song of rejoicing like that.
So let's just go a little further. The last part of Hannah's prayer is perhaps even more telling. Verse 9. She prays, "He will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness, for by strength shall no man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken." Who is she thinking of? The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken. And so it was in her day. For in the birth of her child Samuel, as we read earlier in chapter 7, the enemy was broken. Dagon fell down with his arms cut off before the altar in that pagan Philistine altar. In her days, she saw a temporary realization. Dagon fell down like Nebuchadnezzar's image, apart, dismembered. You see the force of her prayer in view of her local circumstances. "He will keep the feet of his saints, indeed, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness." And in her days, in Samuel's days, that was partly realized. "The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Out of heaven shall he thunder upon them." Now, look at this. Over to Samuel 7. You see the point of that language, which we read earlier? You see the connection, don't you, with verse 10 of 1 Samuel chapter 7. There's no doubt that the local enemy is partly in view here. For notice the language that is used to describe God venting his anger on the Philistines when they're finally routed under Samuel's prayerful direction. Let's read that section again. 1 Samuel 7, verse 10. "And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel." Now watch this. "But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day upon the Philistines and discomfited them, and they were smitten before Israel." What does Hannah pray for? "The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Out of heaven shall he thunder upon them." You see, Hannah's prayer is an epitome of all that's about to transpire in the life of Samuel and further on into the life of David. No doubt, she empties herself before the Lord. No doubt she understands her first principles, young people and sisters and brethren. She was convinced that the kingdom would come, but she was convinced of God's majesty. Convinced, brothers and sisters, that God, let's continue, "the Lord shall judge the ends of the earth, and he shall give strength unto his king and exalt the horn of his Christ," in Hebrew. The word anointed is the word for Christ. "He shall exalt the horn of his Christ." When you read it as it is in the Hebrew, the force of it comes out even more powerfully. You see, there was a sister who was sensitive to the times. The Philistines were making their incursions. The enemy was all around them. She was living in a time of crisis. The lamp was about to go out, not only in the tabernacle, but in all of Israel. Every man was doing that which was right in his own eyes. The ecclesia needed help. It needed help at the Bible class. It needed help on Sunday morning. It needed help in every function. And as a sister, she didn't negate her responsibilities because she was a sister. She was filled with Bible knowledge and understanding, and she used it wisely and modestly, but she used it effectively as a sister. And the Lord complimented her by inspiring her and using her as an agency of truth. No doubt these words are prophetic. No doubt inspired, as well as coming from her own wellspring. She understood the truth. And she could use such scriptural content in her prayer and in her worship that perhaps puts us all to shame. She was a sister that had her priorities straight. And she was, by doing so, an indictment to the nation around her. Contrast Eli, the high priest, and his sons of Belial to this lowly handmaid. She was, in a worldly sense, a nobody in Israel. Who knew Hannah compared to Eli? In that sense, she was a nobody. insignificant, perhaps, but a speck in the myriads of Israel. Insignificant, she would pass through the streets of her hometown, perhaps. Not particularly a shining star, not like a Deborah, not from royal family, but a handmaid of the Lord. But like Mary, the mother of our Lord, like Mary, saturated with Scripture, able to give a word in season, able to give a worthy rebuff to Eli in scriptural terms when she needed a defense for proper conduct, able to defend herself when she needed to, and able to build into her worship and into her prayer a content that was so totally scriptural, something worth striving for, not only for sisters, but for brethren, not only for old, but for young. She wasn't an old woman. She was really a young person in a certain sense. And look at the vision. The Lord shall judge not just the Philistines, not just Dagon, not just the enemies of Israel. The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth. It's a phrase used in the prophets of the Gentiles, of the whole world. And he shall give strength unto his king and exalt the horn of his Christ. Now, that's an exhortation, isn't it, to all of us? It's a reminder of those basic, precious first principles that we all pray for. And young people, and when you go back Tuesday morning and in your high school and in your elementary school, you stand before those fellows and you begin by saying, "Our Father who art in heaven," as the class usually mumbles it, as I hear it every morning myself, "who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth," and it's raced off. The principle comes on, it's all forgotten. You hear that every morning. Do you know, the Lord's Prayer is Hannah's prayer. When the Lord prayed, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," that's what Hannah's praying for. She's praying, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." That's what that means. She is praying for Nebuchadnezzar's image to be destroyed in those terms. She's praying for the time when the king and the Christ will rule the earth, when the wicked will be dismayed. "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." How easy it is to trip off those words every morning as young people in our classrooms. And like the rest in the classroom, think no more about those words. Whether baptized or not, you know, young people, those are first principles. You're praying with the rest in a way that should be better than the rest, in the sense that you know what they mean. "Thy kingdom come." Next time you pray about that on Tuesday morning, think about what it means. When the rest know nothing about those words, you do. You should know as much as Hannah knew, that it's praying for this world to come to an end and for a new era to begin. It's praying for a new creation. It's praying that Christ will return. It's praying the way Hannah prayed. Back to chapter 1. You see, this is the force of verse 11 again, if we come back to there for perhaps the third time. Chapter 1, verse 11. This is what is meant by this title of God. Easy to say we know the title, but the principle is the key one. She vowed, verse 11, a vow, and said, "O Yahweh of armies." Yahweh of armies? Why did she pray that way? Why was God deserving of that title, Yahweh of armies or hosts? It's here in verse 10, isn't it? There's the realization of that title, Yahweh of armies. "The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth, and he shall give strength unto his king and exalt the horn of his Christ." There is Yahweh of armies. There is the time, future especially, when God will be a great host in the earth, and through his saints and his faithful, and before Israel in the world, he will show himself to be a man mighty in war, and he will thunder such as he's never thundered before in the earth. Well, brothers and sisters and young people, by no means have we exhausted the kind of character exhortation that comes from Hannah. But whoever we are, young or old, brother or sister, we find exhortation in her character and Samuel's. He grew as a child and learned to be a minister to the ecclesia. She, in the quiet of her domestic home, despite her tensions, despite her grief, despite a far less than perfect domestic scene, had learned to bear her cross by sharing it with God. And in the meantime, she had grown in the Lord herself as she taught Samuel, so that when the crisis came, her heart was filled with spiritual knowledge and understanding. If there's any secret to how Samuel grew in such a rotten environment, there's the answer. As we've been told more than once, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, but the hand that rocks the cradle in the ecclesia provides children for the Lord.